Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to bitch about this too, but I got a quote and everything for a 35 question poll. And there was only going to be one question about, like, are you voting for Martin or Lee? The rest were all going to be straight policy questions so we could get a better idea of what Democrats should be running on in the state. And not a single donor would go for it. Everyone we talked to was like, I just don't think that's the best use of our money. I was like, okay.
Who cares?
Write that $10,000 check to Val Demings right now.
I know. Fucking infuriating.
Hot pot of the South, not your daddy's Appalachia. Hot pot of the South, progress cannot wait.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pod of the South, a production of Change Tennessee. Pull up a chair and refill your sweet tea as we peel back the layers of Southern politics to get a better understanding of what's going on and why it matters. My name is Gabe, and as always, we're joined by Tennessee's galactic communist revolutionary, Drew Dyson.
Afternoon, all.
And again, this week we have another returning guest. People seem to like us now, which is pretty cool. We're joined by Afton Ben. And I don't even know at this point what you do or who you're the puppet master for, because you kind of just do everything and pull all of the strings. I know last time we said you were HBIC, and I guess that's probably still the case.
Yeah, well, I thought you were describing me when you described Drew's intro. So
we can share that title.
I mean, the Sith Lords do use the power of two, or the rule of two. So. I would watch your back. Drew might be throwing you down a reactor core.
Unless I have a lot more space. Like, I need to work harder. If that's Drew's title, like, I'm falling short. No, it's really, I'm excited to be here. So I'm now the campaign director. I direct at ruralorganizing.org. So we're a national group that works on Senate races, trying to fill rural margins, close margins in rural counties. But yes, I also dabble in Tennessee politics, and I have a lot of feelings after this election, as I'm sure many of your listeners have.
Oh my goodness. I have so many feelings, but I think before we jump into Tennessee politics, let's just take an overarching view of the night that happened. I think, you know, going into this, we heard all these rumors. It's going to be a red wave. It's going to be a wipeout for the Democrats. Historically speaking, it should have been. But I mean, we ended the night pretty well off. And for me, I think, you know, if we're holding it to, fingers crossed, maybe single digits in the House that Republicans gain, that's pretty good. And, you know, so far the Senate looks like maybe we can pull it off without, you know, having to worry about the runoff race. Of course, worry about the runoff race. We still need Raphael Warnock in there. And then we did really well in these governor races. But I do want to point out the one thing that has been aggravating me about last night is the money that was poured into Florida. I don't know what Democrats' obsessions with Florida is. They have this longing love for it as the swing state it once was. But when you look at the demographics, who's moving there, what's changing, it is not a swing state anymore. And I just look at how much money Val Demings spent and just think, God, if we would have spent that money on Sherry Beasley or maybe Tim Ryan, or, you know, maybe if the DNC cared enough about a black candidate's running, maybe we could have pushed Mandela Barnes over the edge in Wisconsin also. And that's ironic to say all three of those are black candidates running, but it's, you know, it's Florida and it just aggravates me. But I'll digress there. I want to hear your all's thoughts on last night as well.
Well, yeah, I think we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit. So if you couldn't tell from both of their opening rants, we're going to be talking about the midterm results from last night.
Yeah, I'm just chomping
at the bit.
This is what I live for.
Yeah. So it's our last trip to the still. We're getting the tails of our moonshine now. So yeah, we're a little delirious from the lead poisoning on it. So bear with us. It's going to be a wild ride.
Nothing to add. I'm enjoying being here. I'm just happy to be in the room. I'm happy to see you too. You're looking good. I love the scruffiness, bringing out the scruffy in Scruffy City. I love it.
this is, you know, that last like 2 weeks of campaigning, or that really the stretch between early voting ends and election day, where the only thing on my mind is data and digging through it and stress. So that's the look we're giving. It's giving politically stressed out progressive in the South realness right now. But so, you know, kind of wrapping up, because I don't want to spend all the time talking and dissecting what happened nationally. I think, you know, there's other places that are going to do that. And, you know, rightly so. I think overall it was a good night. I think, I think it's just something that the DNC has to look at where they're spending money. I think there were opportunities that we could have picked up. You know, we could have treated North Carolina, Ohio.
Yeah, I was cautiously optimistic heading into last night. I think what's clear, even though a few incumbents lost, Representative Cindy Axne's race was just called for the Republican in the Iowa 3rd. Luria lost in Virginia, so there are a few incumbents that lost their House races. But overall, I think abortion. I really feel that this was a motivating factor for not only Democrats. I also think the prognosticators were incredibly off, because guess what? Gen Z is very difficult to get a hold of. Mm-hmm. So they're not answering their landlines. They are not answering text messages. If you are the mother or father of a Gen Z-er, you know you can't get a hold of them. And the youth really turned out, in droves. And I'm really excited to see their trajectory in all of this, because as we all know, if you're not voting, you don't have a seat at the table. But quickly to your point about Florida, I think the Democratic donor base nationally doesn't want to admit that these fledgling battlegrounds are now becoming more and more red, like Ohio, Iowa, and Florida. And I agree with you that those resources would have been much better spent elsewhere. However, it's important to note, and this is such a crazy fact when you think about it, in 20 years, 70% of the United States population will live in 15 states.
Gosh.
So unless we abolish the Senate, we have to have a red state strategy, and Tennessee is included in that. So we ran our deepest program in Ohio. And so I have a lot of comments about what it's like running, you know, field in a battleground state. But if we cede states like Ohio and Iowa, we are never getting them back. And so as we head into these final weeks of 2022, and we're wrapping up conversations with donors, yes, you can go to Mississippi because they have a large minority population and you can register and try to mobilize as many Black voters as possible. But yet again, if you give up Ohio, Iowa, you know, and they've already given up on Tennessee, you know, it's going to be a long slog. So,
yeah. And I guess I should say in the aspect that I'm talking about is Florida is back to a building blocks. It's not a state that you can just mobilize anymore. We've seen, you know, Ron DeSantis come in, you know, purge voters, arrest voters, arrest people attempting to vote. It's made it so much harder. The state was gerrymandered to hell. So there's all these barriers. But I think one of the things that I heard last night that was eye-opening, one, Miami-Dade County swung 11 points to the Republicans last night. And that hasn't happened since, God, I don't remember the last time it happened in a governor's race or Senate race. And so I think the problem now is it's not an overall state that Democrats can win in at the statewide level. But we have to, like you said, we do have to make those investments. There is clearly something that we need to be doing differently in Miami-Dade County right now. And I think it starts there, and it starts in some of these other areas where we were gerrymandered out of. We have to kind of crawl our way back. We have to find this messaging that's going to work. We have to, you know, do massive, massive outreach. But yeah, we also have to compete elsewhere. I guess my concern comes in when the DSCC is deciding where to spend money and to invest resources. I think they fell into the trap of falling into Ron Johnson's plan of just going full-blown racist in the Wisconsin race, and they pulled out. When I think, you know, looking at how close the margins was, if we would have spent a little bit more money or maybe mobilized a little bit more people, I think we could have made a big difference in that race.
Well, and as you intimated earlier, I think the more the margin slims for the Republicans, the less powerful McCarthy is. But also the crazies are going to be just as loony. I do think it was a good night for Democrats in terms of the number of MAGA extremists that were elected. I was hesitant to mention this, but you know, the Democrats didn't get involved in some Republican primaries and spent a lot of money pushing the more extreme candidates. And I just saw a tweet today that all of those Republicans lost. So, you know, even though I'd much rather invest in obviously Democratic primaries and progressive candidates, it did seem that the strategy paid off this cycle. So
they were putting it down to the wire on that one. They had me worried.
One of the issues that we've kind of seen, you know, Drew, you kind of pointed at it with like Florida and like some of these races that we should have done better. And it's also like candidate quality almost, where especially you're talking about with like younger voters after, you know, you said like they're impossible to get in touch with, but they know what's up. And the DNC is marching out these like boilerplate candidates that their peers are going to vote for. Like,
oh, you were rooting for Connor Lamb in the Pennsylvania Senate primary. Is that what you're telling me?
But like, and it goes back, and you know, they're never going to get on board with it. But like the Bernie train, like the Bernie bros, and like feel like that whole movement. I mean, how much he excited the base because of everything he was for. You know, he didn't get into like the identity politics and all that. He was class politics, and that's what matters. People vote with their wallets.
Yeah.
And, you know, they march out these like centrist candidates that are just like, oh, cool. Yeah. Milquetoast. Yay. And it doesn't get people really that excited. People are voting from a necessity, not from a desire.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and maybe a final point on this before we swing our direction over towards Tennessee, but you know, Gabe, there's something there. I think, you know, we saw Trump vaulted to power in 2016 on, you know, a lot of racism for sure, but this message of economic populism that, you know, I think Bernie also hit on as well with younger voters. I think there's a desire from workers, whether you're rural, urban, old, white, black, Hispanic, you know, to hear more about an economy that will work for you. Now, was Trump's message complete bullshit? Of course. But, you know, I think voters want to hear about how we can, you know, make an economy that's not just working for these people at the top. And I'll say, you know, closing into this final days, you know, I'm glad we kept message on abortion. But I did get a little nervous that the economy was not going to, was going to be too much for certain independents to swing their votes in the end.
Well, I mean, populism, like to be a populist used to be code for socialist. Like it used to be like to say you were populist meant like I am for the majority population, not like you said, like the racist, like dog whistle that it means now. And again, you know, same with like the to be a libertarian, like the classical libertarian is an anarchist, is a leftist anarchist. But Democratic leadership has kind of let the right take these labels and make it their own. And then all of a sudden, like people who were part of that were like, wait a minute, where does that leave me? You guys kind of turned your nose up to me.
Yeah, I just two things to say about, I think, abortion, issues of abortion and economy, and then also this this identity, the self-selecting identity, where do I fall on the partisanship line, and the identity, the cultural identity that you hold dear to your heart that you then manifest in the ballot box. And I really loved, there were billboards put up across Texas, and obviously this didn't help Beto at all, but it said, you don't have to be a Democrat to vote Democratic this time. And I think there were tons of ticket splitters in Georgia for Kemp Warnock. There were tons of ticket splitters in Ohio for DeWine Ryan. And so I think in Tennessee, as we shift to Tennessee politics, that there is an opportunity to, you know, what is the Democratic brand, but what does it mean to vote for the best candidate? And right now in Tennessee, I just don't think, like, there's just so much division when it comes to that. But with regard to abortion and the economy, we ran program in Iowa and Ohio. And I ran, you know, the types of text messages I sent would be to abortion supporters or those that were persuaded by the economy, basically Republicans and Democrats. And what was striking is that, you know, it was kind of an either or of a camp, where for me as a female, as a millennial female living in a state that banned abortion, it's a very clear intersection for me, right? Abortion economics, right? Abortion is about economics. I saw something that said, cost of abortion bans for local economies is over $105 billion last year, forcing women out of the workforce. So, I mean, it's detrimental, not only in, you know, obviously forced birth and criminalization of birth is a big deal, but just, I think we need to drive more attention as to like the economics of abortion and child rearing in the United States, because guess what? As a developed country, we are last in almost every single indicator of familial health and well-being.
Well, speaking of being last, I feel like we should turn our attention now to what's going on in Tennessee.
Yeah, <That's> great.
Nice segue there, you know, really, really hyping up our state here. So I guess starting at the top and working our way down, Billy is elected for a second term. Martin underperformed Carl Dane's numbers pretty badly in some cases, and including if you look at the margin of Memphis. Now, this is with 92% reporting in the state, so there still seems to be some outstanding ballots, so the margin could change. But in Shelby County, Martin only ran up by 11 points, and that seems to be one of the tightest races in a while within Shelby County, which is typically a Democratic stronghold, won by, you know, almost 20 points or more.
So wait, you're saying that Martin, I'm sorry, what you're saying, that it was a close margin in Shelby?
Yeah, looking at it, he got 54% of the vote there to Bill Lee's 43%. I'm just kind of, you know, going back through some things, you know, looking at this, you know, typically, most Democrats win in the 60s in Shelby County. So there seems to be a disconnect. And we had the chance to work with Dr. Martin on various things. We supported his campaign. I think he had a strategy for putting himself in every county. I don't think there was a field presence to match that in many counties. And I think that was what was missing. If we're looking at what to diagnose, is that, and just Democratic presence was down. If we look at national averages, I know we talked about this huge Gen Z wave and this youth turnout. We were down comparatively to 2018. We were above 2014, but down 2018. And our urban centers were only running slightly above the statewide average for that, which is, you know, a little bit over 2%. So I think there's a lot of factors in this, but Afton, I want to hear from you, especially knowing that you've worked in Tennessee alongside us before, and you work in rural politics. Just want to get your ideas on what you think happened last night.
Well, and I also, to my in acknowledgement of my street credibility, I have organized in every single congressional district in the state of Tennessee, which is always comical to me when, you know, like guys roll out of bed and decide to run for Congress and they're like, you know, they haven't even stepped foot in any single community event. I'm like, I've been organizing in this congressional district for 6 years. So anyways, but I think I don't want to air a lot of dirty laundry, but I'm very curious. I want to participate in all the debriefs from the hard side, including the caucus and the party, because what I've been hearing most, and it relates to your observation of the lack of a field program, is many of the candidates across the state did not buy into the coordinated effort. And in a state like Ohio that ran an incredibly robust, financially solvent, coordinated campaign, I mean, everywhere, and the campaign name was Workers First. So like, if you looked at a Mobilize event and you wanted to sign up for canvassing, it was about workers. Like, you thought you were going to support workers, and it was really a coordinated effort to support Tim Ryan and the Democratic Supreme Court Justice. But in Tennessee, many of these candidates did not buy in. And I think I have a few criticisms as well as thoughts as to why this happened. I think the Tennessee TNDP has done a great job of hiring impeccable talent. I think they have incredibly high standards for a state like Tennessee. And we have never seen a well-run I will say, non-egotistical coordinated effort. In 2018, Bredesen ran a coordinated, but it was all about Bredesen. It was all about the Bredesen staff. He hired out-of-state talent. He ran the show, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we really need, you know, and a rising tide lifts all boats in a state like Tennessee. And what we really needed was everyone to buy in, for them to be campaigning across the state as a team with all of the same values. And what we got was a hodgepodge of Democratic candidates across the state that no one really knew, had no name ID.
Well, to speak to that too. So this morning, Change TN received an email, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a little bit long, but I figured I'd just read a little bit of it. And I think this is, you know, what really killed his campaign and what really hurts Democrats across the state. But just to start here, we received this email. It says, "I just saw a clip on TV with Jason Martin saying we are not a red state. Well, we are now. I just want to say that living in Germantown, Tennessee, I didn't even know who was running on the Democratic ticket for governor until I cast my ballots. I had several friends ask me who the Democratic nominee was. That about says it all. I never saw the first flyer, ad, TV, debate, anything that had Jason's Martin name on it. It may be my fault for not paying better attention. It makes me feel like he did all his campaigning way east of Tennessee. They may know him and love him in East Tennessee, but in West Tennessee, we didn't even know he was running. If he didn't think Memphis mattered, then he's wrong. This is a heavily Democratic area." So I think what, like I said, you could go onto Jason's social media and see that he was crisscrossing the state all the time. But at those typical events, I think you're not pulling out people that are just nonchalant voters. You're pulling out people that probably attend, you know, meetings with their local Democratic Party, or people that keep up with political events, people that go to rallies, these kind of things. But you're not pulling out regular, everyday people that might be too busy to pay attention to what's going on. And that's really where a field plan comes in. I saw a lot of critiques too from people about there not being TV ads, and you know, that can make or break, but I still think field's the most important thing in terms of what you're going to spend your money on. And if we look at how much money Jason ended up raising, he could have spent some money on TV, but I don't think, you know, Tennessee's not a state where we're making enough money to consistently battle the Mega Millions, I think, that our Republican overlords here in the state are raising. Bill Lee flooded the airwaves, especially if you're in Tennessee, or East Tennessee especially, and you watch the Tennessee-Georgia game. I don't know how many ads I saw during that, but I do know those ads each time were several thousands of dollars. And that would drain just a typical, you know, campaign to run any kind of ad during such a high-profile thing. So I think, you know, TV debate separately, field debate will always be the most important, but I just wanted to share that because I do think that gets at kind of the heart of how important field can be, and having a, you know, being in all 95 counties or visiting all 95 counties is different from campaigning in all 95 counties.
Well, I think there's another bit in that letter too about, like, if you don't think Memphis or Shelby County matters, then you're wrong. And, you know, we've been critical about this since since we started Change. The leadership almost has this feeling where if you're not Nashville, you don't matter. And whether that's kind of like a behind closed door discussion or not, that's how it's interpreted when you get out and talk to people out in the field as well. And it almost feels like you have Middle Tennessee is its whole own identity, and Middle Tennessee people just associate with Middle Tennessee. Same with East Tennessee and West Tennessee. There's no, you know, kind of like what you were talking about, Afton, like there's no coordinated effort between the three different regions. And hell, you could even almost say four regions, because the Tri-City area is its own total different flavor than the rest of East Tennessee because of all the Virginia influence that they get.
I think Memphis would argue there's five reasons and say there's West Tennessee and then there's Memphis.
But still, even that, but that's even the point, that there's so much different flavor in our one state, and no one's really like trying to figure out, like, okay, what do we need to do in your area to resonate with the base? And if there are those conversations, it's not making it into action. An idea without action gets you nowhere. And that's what it feels like is happening.
And I will say that I think TNDP has, I mean, every year since we've all started organizing in the state, everyone wants to blame the party, right? But I think in a well-functioning state, as I may have said on this podcast before, you know, you have three stool legs of the stool, right? You have a functioning caucus that raises and spends money, protects incumbents and supplements program in competitive districts. You have a functioning party that's running a coordinated effort and a functioning dark money table, i.e. side, which is what we do. And in Tennessee, I think, you know, there's such a lack of program, year-round program, that you're not even mobilizing the base. Like, Democrats didn't even turn out this election. And I don't blame them, because there weren't, you know, exciting candidates at the top of the ticket. I had three white men in East Nashville that, you know, there used to be a large percentage of African Americans that live here. And I had three white guys in the four amendments. But I think, you know, we need year-round programming, and especially at the statewide level. Like, the only way we are going to change hearts and minds is by talking to voters. And I have a whole other, I can go on and on with about voter apathy in the state and why I think and how we can fix it, the remedy for it. But in addition to that, you know, the argument I think statewide donors are making to national players, why you should invest in Tennessee, there are a lot of people moving here. Well, yes, but a lot of people who are fleeing mask mandates from California, and their politics aren't exactly where we need them to be. So I don't, you know, even if we have a lot of people moving here, it doesn't necessarily mean they're the right people. And there are also people that clearly don't feel that they should participate in our electoral system. The last thing I want to say is that it's very hard as organizers, I'm sure you two can attest to this, to go into a room and to excite people to say, hey, guess what? The only win we're going to have every 2 years is to flip a state house seat and in perpetuity, right? And even this cycle, we'll talk about the house races, but we didn't even do that. We lost one. And I just, so, you know, it's not exciting, and it's not an exciting offering to voters to, like, for, you know, that we're going to have major successes, because we're absolutely not. They've eliminated any possible way to do that. Finally, electoralism is a system that has only benefited the few. And it's very, you know, I went and canvassed in North Nashville with, you know, in Black communities, and I had doors shut in my face. I had people saying, you know, get the fuck out of, and I walked away saying, I don't blame them. Like, nothing ever changes in this state. Nothing. We have a Republican, nothing ever changes. Why should they vote?
We did a lot of voter outreach via texting, especially to young voters, because, like you said, there's so many young voters that just ignore the process, but they might see a text message. They might not ever answer it, but they might be reminded there's an election coming up. But from some of the ones that we talked to, and we have this conversation with other people as well, that are like, why should I come out and vote? And, you know, as an organizer, you always, your first thing is you want to jump up and down. It's like, well, here's why it's so important. And it's easy for us, I think, to do that, because if we all weren't optimistic people in some form or fashion, we would have gotten out of this a long time ago. So it's easy for these people to be pessimistic and be like, well, I've, you know, lived here forever and I've not seen anything change, or, you know, I see, you know, my Democrat got 25% of the vote last time they ran. I never see the party doing anything in my community. I think there's a lot of reasons for people to not get involved. And it's time for individuals to realize that, you know, one, we didn't show up yesterday. I think there's factors in play in terms of that outside of candidate, you know, recruitment also in the state. I think that's a factor in and of itself, but it's apathy. It's, we don't have power in the state. And I think, like, to what you said, Afton, we constantly hear, always, you know, promote, like, we're shifting the margins or whatnot, and we'll take those, like, you know, that one state house win is a win, and we have to point to those, because unfortunately there's not the momentum put in place just yet for us to pick up, you know, 10 house seats. And that's because, you know, we did a lot of traveling this year going to various counties, and I met with a lot of parties that were doing the work in some very rural areas in Murray County and Monroe County, Meigs County, Roane County, Knox County. You know, there's a lot even in East Tennessee that are doing a lot of hard work in very rural areas, and they're to be applauded. But then I know for a fact that there were areas that we attempted to go into, and, you know, as an organization that might not have roots in there, sometimes it's good to have someone you can lean on before you walk in. And we could not get them to do anything because it's a club to them. They go, they discuss, they bitch about what's going on in the state, and then they never really do anything outside of that. And that's a hindrance. But it also makes it harder for young people to want to get involved when they don't see anything doing that. And I think, you know, one of the things we discussed was we can tell that younger voters tend to interact with Change TN a lot more than they'll interact with their party. That was just evident in the data that we've saw who interacts with us, but there's still a disconnect between those voters interacting and going out to the polls. They really do value these issues, but they don't feel that the electoral politics in Tennessee is the avenue to get things done. And so, to some extent, you have to show them, but you also have to be willing to put in the work to convince them. And it goes back to that you know, stool analogy you were using earlier. After
then, you have the people who are excited and want to show up. They run into the shit that we ran into here in Knoxville yesterday, or what happened in Davidson County, where it was like over 1,000 of the wrong ballots were given, and that just like takes the wind out of their sails. I mean, hell, I stood in line. Okay, I'm a bad activist. I waited till election day. You know, shame on me.
You like the chaos. You like the revelry of election day, as I like to say.
Yeah. But I waited in line for 2 hours. Why? Because my precinct had a printer go down in the morning. They brought a replacement printer, but the replacement printer never got up and running. And they never bothered like calling it in to send someone out to get it replaced. And then there at the end, they were almost running out of paper ballots. At another polling location, they did run out of paper ballots. And it was like consistently hour plus 2 hour plus wait times wherever you were in Knoxville, with the exception of like a couple precincts. Because, you know, unfortunately, I mean, yeah, early voting is a nice long window. But I mean, unless you're like super tapped into this and a masochist like we are, like, you're not on the, like, oh, wait, yeah, it's early voting. It's like, oh, no, it's like election day. I mean, that's, schools get out for it. There's a whole bunch of revelry around election day, but nothing about early voting that could help tamper those delays that takes the wind out of people's sails.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a culture of voting, which you two have said, and we don't have a culture of voting. And then, as you said, when there's not commercials running for the Democratic candidate, you don't get any mail, you're not receiving digital ads on streaming, you have no idea there's an election, and there's no popular things on the ballot. Like, removing slavery from the Constitution is the sexiest thing on our ballot this year? Are you serious? Okay.
All right.
And got a good chunk of votes to not do it.
I had a conversation with a candidate that ran for state senate here, and we had a good chat just about, like, you know, there are things that we could, you know, talk about that don't get a lot of traction, like, and that can maybe increase voter turnout. Of course, I don't think that the supermajority right now would go for this, but, you know, like, Tennessee needs to update the way that we do amendments to the ballot. You know, maybe it doesn't have to go as far as California, where everything ends up on the ballot, but there should be a way for individual organizations to get involved to add something on the ballot. I think if we had something like, hey, let's legalize marijuana on the ballot, that could have drawn a lot of people out that would have been, you know, maybe different voters. maybe people that are finally interested in politics because they might be single issued. But I think, you know, that's an interesting way of looking at it and talking about these things. But yeah, that culture of voting's not there, and we're definitely gonna have to work on that. 2 years, we're gonna have Marsha Blackburn up, and looking at this data, we're anywhere near ready to win a statewide seat. So
not at all. Well, yeah. Let's move to the congressionals. So Nashville, as you all know, is split up. I think they got greedy. I mean, these are two congressional districts. The 7th and the 5th are two congressional districts that, if we start organizing now, we'll be competitive within a 5-4 point margin for 2024. But once again, the work needs to start now. And I think the response from donors and, you know, volunteers is often retreat. Like, oh, we didn't get the outcome we want, we're just going to retreat and we're going to give up on Tennessee. Guess what? Like, us three must like abuse, because we keep coming back like a bad boyfriend. I'm telling you. And there's only so much of this. And there are honestly, and I'm sure you two have had this thought as well, there are moments where I'm like, let's just give it up. Let's just give it to Tommy Lauren and the fascists. Fine. Let's just do it. But once again, we're from here. We love this state. It's the volunteer state. We're volunteering our energy and time and love for our communities to go out there and get butchered every single cycle. But with regard to the congressionals, as I said, I think Odessa did an incredible job. I mean, just shout out for giving someone, this is Odessa. So there was a big anti-trans rally. Matt Walsh organized this big anti-trans rally in Nashville. National people flew in to speak at it. And Odessa was in the middle of the crowd, right next to the Proud Boys, on a mic, screaming, "Trans Lives Matter." And like, where were the other candidates? No one showed up besides her. Like, we were lucky that she ran. I'm so grateful that she spent the time and energy and away from her family to run in this congressional district and to give us a narrative that is different than, you know, the far right Christian nationalists run Tennessee. So shout out to Odessa. Big thank you to her. Senator Campbell, you know, her husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. They announced it a week before the election. So they've been, you know, she was pushing through all of this familial adversity. And I don't know how she did it. So I just, you know, I'm really grateful that they ran. I think they're upset that the results weren't as they expected. But that's, you know, that's running in a state that has weaponized white supremacy, voter suppression, and state preemption.
Yeah, exactly. And those two were very exciting candidates. And we just talked about how Jason did not live up to the margins that he should have. And while we technically lost a House seat for the Democrats, I think it sets us up well enough that even when we're not doing that great on this kind of year, that we're still playing in these races. And like you said, they got greedy. I think, you know, the next election cycle or the one after that, these are going to come down to the wire in some cases, especially if we do the work, like you're saying. It's not going to happen if we just sit back and wait until, and I have a whole part of this on state House and state Senate candidates, but, you know, we have to start the work now. It doesn't start in March of 2024. It starts, you know, this month. I think all these counties, cities, congressional district committees, what have you, they all need to start getting together, diagnosing what happened, figure out what went wrong, and plan ahead. And like you said, when you have exciting candidates like that, that are able to gain their own traction, I mean, one, that's free media right there. You don't have to worry as much about, you know, what you're getting on, especially if you're just running these viral clips. But you know, it really does help increase turnout. I mean, when you think about the counties that Odessa was running up in, these are some very, very red counties. And she was running the margins up in there. And she, you know, for her part, almost broke 40% in what should have been, I believe it's a Trump plus 18 district now. And the same with Heidi, that's a plus Trump 15 district. And she got in the low 40s. So like I said, yeah, they got greedy and we have to start the work early. You know, looking at some of the others, uphill battles still, but we always should have candidates running in these races. But candidate quality does matter. I'll say, you know, here in the second congressional district, he did end up actually doing, I think, slightly better than Renee Hoyos. But
really?
Slightly. maybe. Let's we'll have to compare and contrast a little bit. But he was coming right to par with it. But he was a very lackluster candidate, to say the very least. And, you know, there were a lot of people that I talked to that were willing to write someone else in just because they didn't care for who he was. And these were strong Dems. These were, I even knew, you know, Republicans that voted for Renee Hoyos here twice, who ran in 2018 and 2020 for the second congressional district, that wrote in someone else because, one, they had never heard of him like they heard of her. And so, you know, certain races, it definitely makes a difference, that candidate quality. But yeah, I think the eye on the prize right now is if we can start the work in those two congressional districts, we really have a chance to make something happen, maybe even in 2024, if we actually get our heads out of our ass.
And that goes exactly what you were talking about, Afton, where it's, you have to have year-round programming or year-round events to get people excited, to get people invested, because that's what's going to get them to show up to the polls when they know the candidates or when they know, like, the local party leadership or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so other than the fact that, like, you know, you just want to stop the fascist takeover, which is, you know, should be people's goal right now anyway, but.
Well, especially just about the your congressional district, like, Tim Burchett is a career politician. He has never had a job. He graduated college and ran for office. Like, there's so much, and I'm really proud of the work that you all did with Indivisible Tennessee and East Tennessee in that commercial that ran. Like, I absolutely loved it. But really drawing a contrast between this, like, good old boy, I pick up turtles on the side of the road and move them over and I film it and everyone loves me, which, yes, they do. Okay. But you also, like, you're not moving legislation. You are a career politician and all you do is tweet. But let's shift to the state Senate and state House, if we could. You know, state Senate in Tennessee, God bless, I think they call them I forget what Senator Akbari calls themselves, but it's like the Fighting Six or something. Yeah. You know, they added Senator Campbell last year. And these, you know, what's striking about the state Senate districts is unfortunately, the state Senate map this year, most of these were in rural communities and most of them didn't field Democratic candidates. But I do think next year we'll have the Montgomery County seat open. We'll have a Chattanooga seat open. And I am hopeful about those. It also sucks because Senate District 30 or 31, I forget, Senator Brian Kelsey, who RIP, I hope he likes prison. I hope he, you know, it's going to be good. He's going to get a prison boyfriend. He's going to live his best life. But Senate District 31, you know, they made it more competitive knowing that Gabby Salinas ran, she closed margins in it. He, you know, he's been indicted. He's going to jail. But unfortunately they made it more red with redistricting. It wasn't competitive. But the reason I want to talk about state Senate is I want to give a big shout out to Kate Craig, who just poured her heart and soul into this race in one of the most Republican congressional districts in the country. And it takes a lot to put your name out there. It takes a lot to put your name out there as a gay woman in that area. And I just want to say, I'm so grateful that she ran and, you know, we all deserve a Kate Craig on our ballot.
Yeah, and we endorsed Kate, and just to talk about that a little bit more, that's the first time a Democrat ran against Rusty Crowe since, like, 2002. And she got a fourth of the vote. She got 25%, and it's a newly redrawn district. Northeastern Tennessee is one of the reddest parts of the state. And, you know, knowing what we know now, we got 25% of the vote this time. Again, all this depends on if we work to increase this. But if we work to increase that margin to, you know, 35%, you know, four more years down the road, I mean, one, there's no way we don't get a majority in the state Senate, state House without it going through rural Tennessee. So we have to win these margins and we have to run these candidates. But looking at the state House, you know, we'll probably have two different views on this. I look at this and given the what we saw just across the state, I actually take this as a win last night that we were able to protect our majority. And I know we'll disagree on the idea of protecting our majority when technically a member that caucused with us lost, but he hasn't been a Democrat for some time. So I might be able to swing that a little bit and say we protected the Democratic incumbents. But I mean, it does say something that we did lose John Mark Wendell's seat. He's a former Democrat, runs as an independent. He was the very last rural Democrat, and that domino is gone. But, you know, I actually looked at some of the results from the state House, especially the candidates we endorsed, and I saw some interesting things out of that. So we endorsed Jim Dodson in House District 33 against the literal worst human being in the state House.
He loves talking about what is in little kids' pants. Yeah. Love it. Absolutely love, is obsessed.
Jim, Billy, all these other things. I don't understand the obsession with that. And we'll talk about what their plans are next in a second, too, as we wind down. But, you know, looking at it, I think, one, my favorite thing about the night was that the state legislature absolutely hates and disdains Gloria Johnson. And so they drew her out of her district to potentially put her up against a fight with Sam McKenzie in House District 15, which is a historically Black district in Knoxville. And she moved to the new House District 90. And what was supposed to be, I guess, a more competitive district turned out to be her biggest margin win ever. And so just kind of comical that they, you know, God, they don't think, which this time I'm grateful for, because, you know, I think I saw that. We saw Caleb Himmer pick up his seat, which was a previously Democratic-held seat. He now is the new Democratic State House member there. Ronnie Glenn, same for him. I think another one of the most exciting things to happen last night is Justin Jones officially, you know, getting elected and going to the State House. I'm glad to see, you know, especially some of these, I guess, for lack of a better word, some of these firebrands going to the state house because, you know, and I'll get some flack for this because we do have to have these voices in there. But, you know, when you have someone like John Mark Wendell representing Democrats, sometimes it can be disheartening, especially on issues like abortion, where he was a pro-life Democrat. And it can be disheartening. But I also see some of these, I've seen Democrats before in even really blue areas where they just kind of roll over a lot of times to some of the things the legislature does. And they're not very vocal about what happens. And so I'm glad to see that people like Justin Jones, Jermaine Oliver, Gloria, all going back, Ronnie, I think all these people are great, you know, having them back in there, having a, you know, a vocal and strong Democratic minority is very important for us right now, considering, you know, all of us live on edge from January to May while the state legislature is in session.
Yeah, and it's always like every single session we say, okay, this is the absolute worst legislative session we've ever had. 6 years of this. I'm like, and part of that, you know, when the Roe decision came out, on my staff call, I'm the only one that lives, well, no, my another staff member lives in Arkansas, but, you know, everyone's like, how could this happen? How, you know, it's been so bad. And it's like, we have been under siege for a decade. And the good news is it can't get any worse. And then it does. So I, you know, I hear you, and I'm really grateful that I'm speaking with you two tonight, because I needed that hopeful tint. You're right. Like, we have firebrands like Justin Jones and Gloria returning to the state house despite all the odds against them. And I think that speaks to the resilience of Democrats in this state.
So I've got a special place in my heart for Gregory Kaplan as a fellow tribe member. And, you know, that is one of those where we were in striking distance back in 2018. Let me pull it back up. Greg Mackey was within 3 points in 2018. And then we just shit the bed in 2020. And, you know, that we thought that district was going to be getting away from us. Like, you go from a three-point loss to a 9-point loss. And Greg really came in and put the work back in that district and closed it to where he ended up he lost by 8 points. But I mean, when you're talking about the way that the redistricting has gone, you know, only gaining 1 point doesn't seem like a lot, but it's pretty significant at the end of the day, again, because of how everything has gotten screwed up, where they've really weaponized gerrymandering to try to ride out people out of their districts, you know, all of Glory, the Glory example you were talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one of those like little things where it's like on paper, it's like, well, it's still an L, but when you kind of start diving into the nuance of what that race really meant and what happened there, like it's pretty significant. I mean, for people who aren't that familiar with House District 18, it is a more affluent part of Knoxville. It's not the old money Knoxville, but it is a more affluent part where you kind of have this like weird mix of MAGA bootstrap wealth, where they really just inherited from their parents because they didn't have to buy a house $50,000 over ask. But then you also have a lot of the college educated individuals there who kind of know, like, can read the writing on the wall with what Elaine Davis was really saying. So, you know, I feel good about that district going forward. I think, you know, we get another good candidate, strong candidate in there like Greg, and we can keep eroding away at that. And maybe, you know, with the right candidate and with some year-round programming, building excitement in these 10-point districts, we could flip some of these or really make the Republicans sweat and shit themselves a little bit when, you know, they can't just call it right 5 minutes after polls close like they can do with some races.
Yeah. Well, I think two observations on my end too, and one just picking up on what you said. You know, Greg ran a great campaign. It was great. It was not the margin we had in 2018, for sure. Redistricting happened, and one of the things that they did was, you know, actually they took away, they increased the area in South Knoxville that 18 had, which is a much more redder area, and actually used to be part of Gloria's old district. And so they added that and extended it a little bit more into a rural part of West Knox up towards Anderson County. So, you know, automatically it was going to be a more uphill battle. And this is nothing against Greg too, but Greg got in very close to before the filing deadline. And I really do think, and I want to touch on this, I've kind of been skirting around it to get to this point, is, you know, we've talked about this candidate recruitment that we need to do. You know, the one non-renewable resource that candidates cannot make up is time. And I really do think when we wait until April to really start, you know, oh God, we've got an empty seat, we got to fill it. It's great to have a candidate there, but we do have to realize that they've lost a lot of time in getting to introduce themselves, to getting to talk to people. And I think that was a hindrance on him a little bit. You know, had he had a few more months to maybe, you know, be out and about, he didn't have a primary, so, you know, maybe there's a few more doors to be knocked, maybe some things to learn before and after. I think that's a really big deal for his campaign. And just another note, the GOP ran one of the most racist campaigns here against him, or anti-Semitic, I should say. I mean, they sent out a mailer that enlarged his nose, used various tropes about him. Elaine Davis, yeah.
It was 2022?
Yeah, I mean,
they didn't have that big of a nose.
Yeah, they really
well, he's short, like, he fits the other stuff. Well, he's short and balding, so, like, or thin hair, so, I mean, he gets those trips, but the schnoz is, I mean, that's, come on, they could have done better.
I mean, well, Gabe, let me ask you this. As someone who's been discriminated against in the state for being Jewish already, were you surprised to see these kind of mailers?
Absolutely not. I am more surprised that I didn't get one. I probably would have framed it on my wall. Because, God, if there's one thing I've learned over the course of 2022, it's that Kanye was right, and that Republicans will stop at nothing to remind everybody that Jews, gays, and trans individuals are the absolute scourge of the earth.
You forgot women. Any woman that's not a Republican, I should say.
Right. Sorry, Afton. I didn't include you in there.
Those Nazis, as they would call them.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of looking overall, I would say it's not the night we expected. I think, you know, going into Tennessee, I did not think that we had a chance at a statewide race for obvious reasons. Like we've talked about these field issues. We didn't touch a lot about rural communities. We've kind of mentioned it, but, you know, we have to be in these communities. We have to compete everywhere. It's not just about showing up once or twice. It's about building an actual field operation there. And then, I mean, for me, I know, again, I just think this hopeful thing is what I saw this year was, we had such lower turnout, but we were able to keep the Democrats we had safe. I'm going to take that for now. We used to hemorrhage them year after year. And now we were gaining them for a little bit, but I'll take it. We had a flat year. But also I saw a lot of things happen too in East Tennessee, just in the August elections, in the Knox County August election, we had a 12-point shift in, we almost ousted Glenn Jacobs. We went from 33% in our mayor's race to 45%. And that was effective work on the ground, doing a lot there. Meigs County elected a Democrat. We saw, Knoxville or Knox County gained a school board seat. And same with Hamilton County, Rutherford County gained a seat, and Montgomery County gained two seats. And so, you know, looking at these, we're always going to get lost in, you know, the overall big picture. Tennessee feels like a red state, but there are wins that are popping up, and even in some unexpected places. So I think, you know, for me, all politics starts local. When you have those candidates running in maybe like an August election that are running for county commission that have such a small district that they can reach out and introduce themselves to people, get people to maybe think about politics, that brings them right around to the August election where hopefully you have a state house candidate, you have a state senate candidate, you have a governor candidate. I think it has to be that most local individual can do the most good when you're a candidate, just because you're able to be the face of whatever you're running on, getting people involved. And especially in these rural communities, I think it's very important for them to meet a Democrat, because the only Democrat I can guarantee you they're seeing is Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, AOC on Fox News. And that is their perception of a Democrat until they actually get to someone knocking on their door, or they ended up meeting them at a event and they talk to them and they realize, okay, you're not a pedophilia demon child murderer, so maybe I can think about this. And then that's where that field game comes in, because that is the true part. I think one of the things that, you know, I'm rambling on here, but we hear so many times from people that, you know, we're the first Democrats that have ever knocked on their door, or we're the first campaign that's ever talked to them. Those are stories you always hear, and that makes an absolute difference, because I know the Republicans are taking these rural voters for granted.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, I mean, overwhelmingly our research shows that local people, local messengers, local people running for office in rural communities can decrease the deficits by double digits. They already have social capital. They have these networks that they can tap into. I think that's very difficult for congressional candidates that are maybe from the metropolitan city within their congressional district, and then they go out in these rural communities. But local candidates, local messages, local is the way to inoculate against the hyper-nationalization that we see at the doors, you know, canvassing for these city council races, and they're asking about abortion. Like, it's the only way to inoculate against hyper-nationalization.
So I want to kind of get y'all's closing thoughts. I mean, on paper, at the state level, it's not pretty. But as we kind of went in, you know, looking at the nuance of it, it's not so bad at the federal level. Kind of held our ground. We were expecting a bloodbath there as well. At least that's what my uncle says on Facebook. You know, he was predicting that good old red tsunami. But we didn't really see that. So kind of just want to get y'all's closing thoughts on that, on how this midterm looked and what we can expect starting tomorrow, you know, really for moving forward.
Gabe, I want it to be known in our little group chat, I predicted that it was never going to be a red wave, and I will stand by that. It's one of the handful of political analysis I got right beforehand, so I'm taking that. But what I did look at, you know, overall, national level, it's such a big deal when Democrats actually, I mean, think about how long Democrats skirted around the abortion issue because they thought it would kill them in elections. We literally had to wait until it was the worst case scenario for them to start talking about it. And, you know, I think that made a difference. I think, you know, Democrats can walk and chew gum. We can talk about abortion rights, talk about the stakes of democracy while also carrying the fears of economic turmoil. You know, at the state level, I wasn't what I wanted, no, but I see signs for optimism. I see, you know, the same thing, unfortunately, we have to deal with all the time is, you know, we're going to have two more sessions before we get another chance to do something. I'm disappointed that we have so many open seats. But, you know, I saw signs of some improvement in certain places that we need to keep improving in and that we also need to start branching out from. So, you know, I mean, for me, the work begins today with doing this, kind of doing a breakdown of it, getting our ideas and talking about this out loud because it helps to process it, especially from different people. And, you know, at Change TN's forefront, we are looking in 2023 to building a better Tennessee. And, you know, that starts with this weekend. We have a very long meeting planned to dissect what we did right and wrong, what we felt we saw others do right and wrong, and just make some commitments on what our goals are in 2023, 2024, and go from there. But Afton.
It's been a day. It's been a day. No, I want to end on a hopeful note, but first a little critical observation. I think, Drew, you said, and rightfully so, that in Tennessee, we do not have a demographic like Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia. So if you're not organizing in these white rural communities, you're never going to win statewide. And I think there is a progressive ethos that as long as we just have to register and mobilize as many Black people as possible. And it's like, yes, yes, because our focal point and our power building center core should be to build the Black and brown working class, right? However, in a state like Tennessee, you cannot neglect the demographics as they stand. And if you're not organizing in rural communities, you're never going to win. End of statement, period. The second thing is that I think a route outside of electoralism that we should focus on in the state is increasing labor density. We have some of the highest numbers of low-paid healthcare workers in the entire country. These home health aides that are hospice workers that, so, you know, are paid for by Medicare and Medicaid in the state, they get paid $7-$8 an hour to take care of our people, and they're ripe for mobilization. They're ripe for, you know, running labor drives to say your labor as a caregiver is important and we are going to put money behind it. And so I think there's just so much opportunity across the state for labor organizing. And I do feel like that is the next iteration, the next wave of Democratic power building in the South, is that we've got to, you know, obviously the Right to Work Amendment lost, but inevitably, like, I want national organizations to come in and just start running labor drives left and right in the state, like Tennessee, because I do feel like we can retreat back to our roots. And then lastly, I just want to echo what you said, Drew, about abortion. I can't believe that I'm hearing, you know, the Democrats in Tennessee aren't skirting around the word abortion. And I think that is a win. That's a big win nationally. I think it's a big win that the national apparatus, Democratic apparatus, is forefront about abortion access, which is so much further than we've ever been on that. I also think, like, I was really scared last night. I mean, I think this country, it is an empire in decline, but it could have been an empire decline on the verge of authoritarian fascism. And instead, there is hope, I think, for me. And the system that we have is seriously flawed. This was the most expensive election ever in the United States history. It's $16.8 billion. That money could have gone anywhere else, right? But I think what I'm excited, yeah, youth turnout, abortion front and center, and honestly, that groups like Change Tennessee continue to do the work in this state, because if it's not for you, I don't know who else is going to be organizing in these communities. So,
well, guys, I think that about covers it for tonight. Afton, I appreciate you being on. Always great to talk with you and get your insight. I'm sure hopefully we'll do this again soon.
Hopefully. All right. You all have a wonderful night. Thanks. You do. Oh, Gabe's got
a before you. What about your internet home and some pluggables? Where can people find you?
I will be tweeting about Chonky Cats and Tennessee politics at Afton, AFTYNBEHN on Twitter. If you want the updates on federal politics, but also, you know, what's going on at the congressional level of Tennessee, please hit me up.
Drew, what about you?
They can find me at Andrew Dyson on Twitter, tweeting about all things Taylor Swift, Star Wars, and Tennessee politics, as well as federal politics. And then make sure to also follow us at ChangeTN_ on Twitter as well, to catch up on all the work that we're doing.
All right. Well, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @pod_south. You can find me on Twitter at @Graham851. I am not an Elon Musk impersonator, because I want to hold on to my Twitter for as long as I can. But be sure to follow us and leave us those sweet, sweet 5-star reviews, as they help others discover us and hear the siren songs of Appalachian leftists. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
Pod, pod of the South, not your daddy's Appalachian. Pod, pod of the South, progress cannot wait.